shirt to replace the one I'd lost. Today I'd gone to Imre for some Basel filings I needed for my current project, a large sympathy lamp using two emitters I'd saved for myself. I hoped to turn a tidy profit. It may seem odd that I was constantly buying materials for my artificing over the river, but the truth was merchants near the university frequently took advantage of the students' laziness and raised their prices. It was worth the walk for me if I could save a couple of pennies. After I finished my errand, I headed to the Aeolian. Diok was at his usual post, leaning against the doorway.
"I've been keeping an eye out for your girl," he said.
Irritated at how transparent I must seem, I muttered, "She's not my girl." Diok rolled his eyes.
"Fine. The girl, Denna, Deanne, Diane, whatever she's calling herself these days. I haven't seen hide nor hair of her. I even asked around a little. Nobody's seen her in a full span. That means she's probably left town. It's her way. She does it at the drop of a hat."
I tried not to let my disappointment show. "You didn't have to go to the trouble," I said, "but thanks all the same."
"I wasn't asking entirely on your account," Diok admitted. "I've a fondness for her myself."
"Do you now?" I said as neutrally as I could manage.
"Don't give me that look. I'm not any sort of competition."
He gave a crooked smile.
"Not this time around, at any rate. I might not be one of you university folk, but I can see the moon on a clear night. I'm smart enough not to stick my hand in the same fire twice."
I struggled to get my expression back under control, more than slightly embarrassed. I don't usually let my emotions go parading around on my face. "So, you and Denna..."
"Stanchion still gives me a hard time about chasing after a girl half my age."
He shrugged his broad shoulders sheepishly.
"For all that, I'm still fond of her. These days she reminds me of my littlest sister more than anything."
"How long have you known her?" I asked, curious.
"I wouldn't say I really know her, lad, but I met her, what, about 2 years back? Not that long, maybe a year and little change."
Diok ran both of his hands through his blonde hair and arched his back in a great stretch, the muscles in his arms straining against his shirt. Then he relaxed with an explosive sigh and looked out at the nearly empty courtyard.
"The door won't be busy for hours yet. Come give an old man an excuse to sit and have a drink."
He jerked his head in the direction of the bar. I looked at Diok, tall, muscular, and tanned. "Old man? You've still got all your hair and your teeth, don't you? What are you, 30?
"Nothing makes a man feel older than a young woman."
He laid a hand on my shoulder.
"Come on, share a drink with me."
We made our way over to the long mahogany bar, and he muttered as he looked over the bottles.
"Beer dulls a memory. Brand sets it burning. But wine is the best for a sore heart's yearning."
He paused and turned to look at me. His brow furrowed.
"I can't remember the rest of that, can you?"
"Never heard it before," I said. "But Tekem claims that out of all the spirits, only wine is suited to reminiscence. He said a good wine allows clarity and focus, while still allowing a bit of comforting coloration of the memory."
"Fair enough,"
he said, picking through the racks before drawing out a bottle and holding it up to a lamp peering through it.
"Let's view her in a rosy light, shall we?"
He grabbed two glasses and led us off to a secluded booth in the corner of the room.
"So you've known Denna for a while," I prompted as he poured each of us a glass of pale red wine.
He slouched back against the wall.
"Off and on. More off, honestly."
"What was she like back then?" Diok spent several long moments pondering his answer, giving the question more serious consideration than I'd expected. He sipped his wine.
"The same," he said at last. "I suppose she was younger, but I can't say she seems any older now. She always struck me as being older than her years."
He frowned.
"Not old, really. More
mature," I suggested. He shook his head.
"No, I don't know a good word for it. It's like if you look at a great oak tree. You don't appreciate it because it's older than the other trees or because it's taller. It just has something that other younger trees don't. Complexity, solidity,
significance.
Deok scowled, irritated.
Damn if that isn't the worst comparison I've ever made.
A smile broke onto my face. It's nice to see I'm not the only one who has trouble pinning her down with words.
She's not much for being pinned down,
Deok agreed, and drank off the rest of his wine. He picked up the bottle and tapped the mouth of it lightly against my glass. I emptied it, and he poured again for both of us. Deok continued.
She was just as restless then and wild, just as pretty, prone to startle the eye and stutter the heart.
He shrugged again.
As I said, largely the same. Lovely voice, light of foot, quick of tongue, men's adoration and women's scorn in roughly equal amounts.
Scorn? I asked. Deok looked at me as if he didn't understand what I was asking.
Women hate Denna,
he said plainly, as if repeating something we both already knew.
Hate her?
The thought baffled me.
Why?
Deok looked at me incredulously, then burst out laughing.
Oh, good Lord, you really don't know anything about women, do you?
I would ordinarily have bristled at his comment, but Deok was nothing but good-natured.
Think of it. She's pretty and charming. Men crowd round her like stags in rut.
He made a flippant gesture.
Women are bound to resent it.
I remembered what Sim had said about Deok not a span ago. He's managed to get the most beautiful woman in the place again. It's enough to make you hate a man.
I've always felt she was rather lonely, I volunteered. Maybe that's why.
Deok nodded solemnly.
There's truth to that. I never see her in the company of other women folk, and she has about as much luck with men as...
He paused, groping for a comparison.
As... Damn.
He gave a frustrated sigh.
Well, you know what they say. Finding the right analogy is as hard as...
I put on a thoughtful expression.
As hard as...
I made an inarticulate, grasping gesture. Deok laughed and poured more wine for both of us. I began to relax. There was a sort of camaraderie that rarely exists except between men who have fought the same enemies and known the same women.
Did she tend to disappear back then, too? I asked.
He nodded.
No warning, just suddenly gone. Sometimes for a span, sometimes for months.
No fickleness in flight like that of wind or women's fancy, I quoted.
I meant it to be musing, but it came out bitter.
Do you have any guess as to why?
I've given some thought to that,
Deok said philosophically.
In part, I think it is her nature. It could be she simply has wandering blood.
My irritation cooled a bit at his words. Back in my troop, my father occasionally made us pull up stakes and leave a town, despite the fact that we were welcome and the crowds were generous. Later, he would often explain his reasoning to me. A glare from the constable, too many fond sighs from the young wives in town. But sometimes he had no reason. We Ru are meant to travel, son. When my blood tells me to wander, I know enough to trust it.
Our circumstances are probably responsible for most of it.
Deok continued.
Circumstances?
I asked, curious. She never talked of her past when we were together, and I was always careful not to press her. I knew what it was like, not wanting to talk too much about your past.
Well, she doesn't have any family or means of support. No long-standing friends able to help her out of a tight spot if the need arises.
I haven't got any of those things either, I groused, the wine making me a little surly.
There's more than a little difference there, Deok said with a hint of reproach. A man has a great many opportunities to make his way in the world. You found yourself a place at the university, and if you hadn't, you would still have options.
He looked at me with a knowing eye.
What options are available to a young, pretty girl with no family, no dowry, no home?
He began to hold up fingers.
There's begging and whoring, or being some lord's mistress, which is a different slice of the same loaf. And we know our Denna doesn't have it in her to be a kept woman or someone's docks.
There's other work to be had, I said, holding up fingers of my own. Seamstress, weaver, serving girl.
Deok snorted and gave me a disgusted look.
Come now, lad, you're smarter than that. You know what those places are like, and you know
that a pretty girl with no family ends up being taken advantage of just as often as a whore and paid less for her trouble.
I flushed a bit at his rebuke, more than I would have normally, as I was feeling the wine. It was making my lips and the tips of my fingers a little numb. Diok filled our glasses again.
She's not to be looked down on for moving where the wind blows her. She has to take her opportunities where she finds them. If she gets the chance to travel with some folk who like her singing or with a merchant who hopes her pretty face will help him sell his wares, who's to blame her for pulling up stakes and leaving town? And if she trades on her charm a bit, I'll not look down on her because of it. Young gents court her, buy her presents, dresses, jewellery.
He shrugged his broad shoulders.
If she sells those things for money to live, there's nothing wrong in that. They are gifts freely given and hers to do with as she pleases.
Diok fixed me with a stare.
But what is she to do when some gent gets too familiar? Or gets angry at being denied what he considers bought and paid for? What recourse does she have? No family, no friends, no standing, no choice. None but to give herself over to him, all unwilling.
Diok's face was grim.
Or to leave. Leave quickly and find better weather. Is it any surprise, then, that she's harder to lay hands on than a wind-blown leaf?
He shook his head, looking down at the table.
Nah, I do not envy her her life, nor do I judge her.
His tirade seemed to have left him spent and slightly embarrassed. He didn't look up at me as he spoke.
For all that, I would help her, if she would let me.
He glanced up at me and gave a chagrined smile.
But she's not the sort to be beholden to anyone. Not one whit, not a hair's breadth.
He sighed and dribbled the last drops of the bottle evenly into our glasses.
You've shown her to me in a new light, I said honestly. I'm ashamed I didn't see it for myself.
Well, I've had a head start on you, he said easily. I've known her longer.
Nevertheless, I thank you, I said, holding up my glass. He held up his own.
To Dianai, he said, most lovely.
To Denna, full of delight.
Young and unbending, bright and fair, ever sought, ever alone.
So wise and so foolish, I said, so merry and so sad.
Gods of my fathers, Diok said reverently, keep her always so, unchanging, past my understanding, and safe from harm.
We both drank and set down our glasses.
Let me buy the next bottle, I said.
It would tap out my slowly hoarded line of credit with the bar, but I found myself increasingly fond of Diok, and the thought of not standing my round with him was too galling to consider.
Stream, stone, and sky,
he swore, rubbing at his face.
I dare not. Another bottle, and we'd be slitting our wrists into the river before the sun goes down.
I made a gesture to a serving girl. Nonsense, I said. We'll just change to something less maudlin than wine. I didn't notice I was being followed when I returned to the university. Perhaps my head was so full of Denna that there was little room left for anything else. Perhaps I had been living civilized for so long that the hard-earned reflexes I'd picked up in Tarbin were starting to fade. The Blackberry brand probably had something to do with it as well. Diok and I had talked for a long while, and between us drank half a bottle of the stuff. I had brought the remainder of the bottle back with me, as I knew Simon had a taste for it. Small matter why I didn't notice them, I suppose. The result was the same. I was strolling down a poorly lit part of Newhall Lane when something blunt struck me on the back of the head, and I was bundled off into a nearby alley, half senseless. I was only stunned for a moment, but by the time I had regathered my wits, I had a heavy hand clamped over my mouth.
All right, Cully,
the huge man behind me spoke into my ear.
I've got a knife on ya. You struggle, I stick ya. That's all there is to it.
I felt a gentle prod against my ribs under my left arm.
Check the finder,
he said to his companion. A tall shape was all I could see in the dim light of the alley. He bowed his head, looking at his hand.
I can't tell. Light a match, then. We have to be sure.
My anxiety began to blossom into full-blown panic. This wasn't some simple back-alley coshing. They hadn't even checked my pockets for money. This was something else.
"We know it's him,"
the tall one said impatiently.
"Let's just do this and have it over with. I'm cold."
"Like hell, check it now while he's close. We've lost him twice already. I'm not having another cock-up like an aniline."
"I hate this thing,"
the tall man said as he went through his pockets, presumably looking for a match.
"You're an idiot,"
the one behind me said.
"It's cleaner this way, simpler. No confusing descriptions, no names, no worrying about disguises. Follow the needle, find our man, and have done with it."
The matter-of-fact tone of their voices terrified me. These men were professionals. I realized with sudden certainty that Ambrose had finally taken steps to ensure I would never bother him again. My mind raced for a moment, and I did the only thing I could think of. I dropped the half-full bottle of brand. It shattered on the cobblestones, and the night air was suddenly filled with the smell of blackberries.
"That's great," the tall man hissed. "How about you let him ring a bell while you're at it?"
The man behind me tightened his grip on my neck and shook me hard just once, the same way you would do to a naughty puppy.
"Not at it,"
he said, irritated. I went limp, hoping to lull him, then concentrated and muttered a binding against the man's thick hand.
"Served it,"
the man replied.
"If you stepped in glass, it's your own damn
He let out a startled shout as the pool of brand around our feet caught fire. I took advantage of his momentary distraction and twisted away from him, but I wasn't quite quick enough. His knife tore a bright line of pain across my ribs as I pulled away and began pelting down the alley. But my flight was short-lived. The alley dead-ended against a sheer brick wall. There were no doors, no windows, nothing to hide behind or use to get a leg up on the wall. I was trapped. I turned to see the two men blocking the mouth of the alley. The large one was stamping his leg furiously, trying to extinguish it. My left leg was burning as well, but I didn't spare a thought for it. A little burn would be the least of my problems if I didn't do something quick. I looked around again, but the alley was distressingly clean. Not even any decent garbage to use as a makeshift weapon. I frantically ran through the contents of my cloak's pockets, desperately trying to form some sort of plan. Some pieces of copper wire were useless. Salt? Could I throw it in their eyes? No. Dried apple, pen and ink, a marble, string, wax. The large man finally beat out the flames, and the two of them began to make their slow way down the alley. The light from the circle of burning brand flickered across the blades of their knives. Still going over my countless pockets, I found a lump that I didn't recognize. Then I remembered. It was the sack of Basil's shavings I had bought to use for my sympathy lamp. Basil is a light, silvery metal, useful in certain alloys that I would be using to construct my lamp. Manet, ever the careful teacher, had taken care to describe the dangers of every material we used. If it gets hot enough, Basil burns with an intense white-hot flame. I hurriedly untied the pouch. The trouble was I didn't know if I could make this work. Things like candle wicking or alcohol are easy to light. They just need a focused flash of heat to get them going. Basil was different. It needed a great deal of heat to ignite, which is why I wasn't worried about carrying it around in my pocket. The men came a few slow steps closer, and I flung the handful of Basil shavings in a wide arc. I tried to get it close to their faces but didn't hold much hope. The shavings had no real heft. It was like throwing a handful of loose snow. Lowering one hand to the flame, licking at my leg, I focused my Allah. The wide pool of burning brand winked out behind the two men, leaving the alley in pitch darkness. But there still wasn't enough heat. Reckless with desperation, I touched my bloody side, concentrated, and felt a terrible cold tear through me as I pulled more heat from my blood. There was an explosion of white light, blinding in the dark of the alley. I closed my eyes, but even through my lids the burning Basil was piercingly bright. One of the men screamed, high and terrified. When I opened my eyes, I could see nothing but blue ghosts dancing over my vision. The scream faded to a low moaning, and I heard a thump as if one of the men had stumbled and fallen. The tall man began to babble, his voice little more than a terrified sobbing.
Oh, God, Sam, my eyes, I'm blind.
As I listened, my vision cleared enough for me to see the vague outlines of the alley. I could see the dark shapes of both men. One was kneeling with his hands in front of his face. The other was sprawled motionless on the ground farther down the alley. It looked like he had run headlong into a low rafter beam at the mouth of the alley and knocked himself unconscious. Scattered around the cobblestones, the remnants of basil were sputtering out like tiny blue-white stars. The kneeling man was only flash-blind, but it would last for several minutes, long enough for me to get well away from here. I moved slowly around him, being careful to step quietly. My heart leapt into my throat as he spoke up again.
Tam?
The man's voice was high and frightened.
I swear, Tam, I'm blind. The kid called down lightning on me.
I saw him go down onto all fours and begin to feel around with his hands.
You were right. We shouldn't have come here. No good comes to meddling with these sort of folk.
Lightning. Of course. He didn't know a thing about real magic. It gave me a thought. I took a deep breath, settling my nerves.
Who sent you?
I demanded in my best tarball in the great voice. It wasn't as good as my father's, but it was good. The big man gave a wretched moan and stopped feeling around with his hands.
Oh, sir, don't do anything that...
I'm not asking again.
I cut him off angrily.
Tell me who sent you. And if you lie to me, I'll know.
I don't know a name,
he said quickly.
We just get off the coin and the hair. We don't know names. We don't actually meet, I swear.
A hare. The thing they had called a finder was probably some sort of dowsing compass. Though I couldn't make anything that advanced, I knew the principles involved. With a piece of my hair, it would point towards me no matter where I ran.
If I ever see either of you again, I will call down worse than fire and lightning,
I said menacingly as I edged toward the mouth of the alley. If I could get hold of their finder, I wouldn't have to worry about them tracking me down again. It had been dark, and the hood of my cloak had been up. They might not even know what I looked like.
Thank you, sir,
he babbled.
I swear you won't see hide or hear of us after this. Thank you.
I looked down at the fallen man. I could see one of his pale hands against the cobblestones, but it was empty. I looked around, wondering if he had dropped it. It was more likely that he'd tucked it away. I moved closer still, holding my breath. I reached into his cloak, feeling for pockets, but his cloak was pinned under his body. I took gentle hold of his shoulder and eased him, slowly. Just then, he let out a low moan and rolled the rest of the way onto his back under his own power. His arm flopped loosely onto the cobbles, bumping my leg. I would like to say I simply took a step away, knowing that the tall man would be groggy and still half blind. I'd like to tell you I remained calm and did my best to intimidate them further, or at the very least that I said something dramatic or witty before I left. But that would not be the truth. The truth was, I ran like a frightened deer. I made it nearly a quarter of a mile before the darkness and my dazzled vision betrayed me, and I ran headlong into a horse tether, crumpling to the ground in a painful heap. Bruised, bleeding, and half blind, I lay there. Only then did I realize I wasn't being chased at all. I dragged myself to my feet, cursing myself for a fool. If I'd kept my wits about me, I could have taken their dowsing compass away, ensuring my safety. As it was, I'd have to take other precautions. I made my way back to Anchor's. But when I arrived, all the inn's windows were dark and the door was locked. So, half drunk and wounded, I made my way up to my window, tripped the latch, and tugged, but it wouldn't open. It had been at least a span of days since I'd come back to the inn so late that I'd been forced to use my window route. Had the hinges rusted? Bracing myself against the wall, I drew out my hand lamp and thumbed it onto its dimmest setting. Only then did
did I see something lodged firmly into the crack of the window frame. Had anchors wedged my window shut? But when I touched it, I realized it wasn't wood. It was a piece of paper, much folded over. I tugged it free, and the window came open easily. I clambered inside. My shirt was ruined, but when I stripped it off, I was relieved by what I saw. The cut wasn't particularly deep. Painful and messy, but less serious than when I'd been whipped. Fela's cloak was torn too, which was irritating, but everything said it would be easier to patch that than my kidney. I made a mental note to thank Fela for choosing a nice, thick fabric. Stitching it up could wait. For all I knew, the two men had recovered from the little scare I'd given them and were already dousing for me again. I left through the window, leaving my cloak behind so as not to get any blood on it. I hoped the lateness of the hour and my natural stealth would keep me from being seen. I couldn't begin to guess what rumors would start if someone saw me running across the rooftops late at night, bloody and naked to the waist. I gathered up a handful of leaves as I made my way to the roof of a livery, overlooking the pennant courtyard near the archives. In the dim moonlight, I could see the dark, shapeless shadows of leaves swirling over the gray of the cobblestones below. I ran my hand roughly through my hair, ending up with a few loose strands. Then I dug at a seam of tar on the roof with my fingernails and used some to stick the hair to a leaf. I repeated this a dozen times, dropping the leaves off the roof, watching as the wind took them away in a mad dance back and forth across the courtyard. I smiled at the thought of anyone trying to douse for me now, trying to make sense of the dozens of contradictory signals as the leaves swirled and spun in a dozen different directions. I'd come to this particular courtyard because the wind moved oddly here. I'd only noticed it after the autumn leaves began to fall. They moved in a complex, chaotic dance across the cobblestones, first one way, then another, never falling into a predictable pattern. Once you noticed the wind's odd swirlings, it was hard to ignore. In fact, viewed from the roof like this, it was almost hypnotic. The same way flowing water or a campfire's flames can catch your eye and hold it. Watching it tonight, weary and wounded, it was rather relaxing. The more I watched it, the less chaotic it seemed. In fact, I began to sense a greater underlying pattern to the way the wind moved through the courtyard. It only looked chaotic because it was vastly, marvelously complex. What's more, it seemed to be always changing. It was a pattern made of changing patterns. It was...
"You're up studying awfully late," said a quiet voice from behind me.
Startled, out of my reverie, my body tensed, ready to bolt. How had someone managed to get up here without my noticing? It was Elodie. Master Elodie. He was dressed in a patched set of trousers and a loose shirt. He waved idly in my direction and crouched down to sit cross-legged on the edge of the roof, as casually as if we were meeting for a drink in a pub. He looked down into the courtyard.
"It's particularly good tonight, isn't it?"
I folded my arms, ineffectually trying to cover my bare bloody chest. Only then did I notice the blood on my hands was dry. How long had I been sitting here, motionless, watching the wind?
"Master Elodine,"
I said, then stopped. I had no idea what I could possibly say in a situation like this.
"Please, we're all friends here. Feel free to call me by my first name, Master."
He gave a lazy grin and looked back down towards the courtyard. Hadn't he noticed the state I was in? Was he being polite? Maybe. I shook my head. There was no use guessing with him. I knew better than anyone that Elodine was cracked as the potter's cobbles.
"Long ago,"
Elodine said conversationally, not taking his eyes from the courtyard below,
"when folk spoke differently, this used to be called the Kuo Yan Hail. Later they called it the questioning hall, and students made a game of writing questions on slips of paper and letting them blow about. Rumor had it you could divine your answer by which way the paper left the square."
He pointed to the roads that left gaps between the grey buildings.
Yes. No, maybe. Elsewhere. Soon.
He shrugged.
It was all a mistake, though. Bad translation. They thought Kwayan was an early root of Kwetentan. Question, but it isn't. Kwayan means wind. This is rightly named. The House of the Wind.
I waited a moment to see if he intended to say any more. When nothing was forthcoming, I got slowly to my feet.
That's interesting, Master.
I hesitated, not sure how serious he had been before. But I should be going. Elodie nodded absently and gave a wave that was half farewell, half dismissal. His eyes never left the courtyard below, following the ever-changing wind. Back in my room at Anchors, I sat on my bed for a long minute in the dark, trying to decide what to do. My thoughts were muddy. I was weary, wounded, and still a little drunk. The adrenaline that had kept me going earlier was slowly turning sour, and my side burned and stung. I took a deep breath and tried to focus my thoughts. I'd been moving on instinct so far, but now I needed to think things through carefully. Could I go to the Masters for help? For a moment, hope rose in my chest, then fell. No, I had no proof that Ambrose was responsible. What's more, if I told them the whole story, I would have to admit that I had used sympathy to blind and burn my attackers. Self-defense or no, what I'd done was unquestionably malfeasance. Students had been expelled for less than that, just to preserve the university's reputation. Nope, I couldn't risk being expelled over this. And if I went to the medica, there would be too many questions. Any word of my injury would get around if I went in to get stitched. That meant Ambrose would know how close he had come to succeeding. It would be better to give the impression that I had walked away unscathed. I had no idea how long Ambrose's hired killers had been following me. One of them had said, "We already lost him twice. That means they could know I had a room here at Anchors. I might not be safe here." I locked the window and drew the curtain before turning on my hand lamp. The light revealed the forgotten piece of paper that had been wedged into my window. I unfolded it and read. Quoth, "Getting up here is every bit as much fun as you made it look. However, springing your window took some time. Finding you not at home, I hope you do not mind me borrowing paper and ink enough to leave this note. As you were not playing downstairs or peacefully abed, a cynical person might wonder what you were doing at this late hour, and if you are up to no good. Alas, I shall have to walk back home tonight without the comfort of your escort or the pleasure of your company. I missed you this felling past at the Aeolian, but though denied your company, I had the good fortune to meet someone quite interesting. He is a quite singular fellow, and I am eager to tell you what little I can of him when next we meet. I currently have rooms at the Swan and Swale in Imre. Please call on me before the 23rd of this month, and we will have our lunch belated. After that, I will be about on my business. Your friend and apprentice housebreaker, Denner. Postscript, please rest assured that I did not notice the disgraceful condition of your bed linens and did not judge your character thereby." Today was the 28th. The letter didn't have a date, but it had probably been there for at least a span and a half. She must have left it only a few days after the fire in the fishery. I briefly tried to decide how I felt about it, flattered that she had tried to find me, furious that the note had gone unfound until now. As to the matter of the fellow that she had met, it was far too much for me to deal with at the moment, weary, wounded, and still somewhat the worse for drink. Instead, I quickly cleaned the shallow cut as best I could using my wash basin. I would have put some stitches in it myself, but I couldn't get a good angle. It started bleeding again, and I cut off the cleaner pieces of my ruined shirt to fashion a makeshift bandage. Blood. The men who tried to kill me still had the dowsing compass, and I'd undoubtedly left some of my blood on his knife. Blood would be vastly more effective in a dowsing compass than a simple hair. That meant that even if they didn't already know where I lived, they might be able to find me despite the precautions I'd taken. I moved around my room quickly, stuffing everything of value into my travel sack, as I didn't know when it would be safe to return. Under a stack of papers, I found a small folding knife I'd forgotten about after I'd won it off Sim playing corners. It would be worth next to nothing in a fight, but that was better than nothing at all. Then I grabbed my loot and cloak and snuck downstairs into the kitchen, where I was lucky enough to find an empty Velligan wine pot with a wide mouth. It was a minor piece of luck, but I was glad for whatever I could get at this point. I headed east and crossed the river, but didn't go all the way into Imray proper. Instead, I headed south a bit, to where a few docks, a seedy inn, and a handful of houses perched on the bank of the wide Omethi River. It was a small port that serviced Imray, too small to have a name of its own. I stuffed my bloody shirt into the wine pot and made it watertight with a piece of sympathy wax. Then I dropped it in the Omethi River and watched it bob slowly downstream. If they were dousing for my blood, it would seem like I was heading south, running. Hopefully, they'd follow it. Chapter 70. Signs. I came suddenly awake early the next morning. I didn't know exactly where I was, only that I wasn't where I should be, and that something was wrong. I was hiding. Someone was after me. I was curled up in the corner of a small room. I lay on a blanket, and I was wrapped in my cloak. This was an inn. It slowly came back to me. I had rented a room in an inn near Imray's docks. I came to my feet, stretching carefully so as not to aggravate my wound. I'd pushed the dresser against the room's only door and tied the window shut with a length of rope, despite the fact that it was too small for a grown man to fit through. Seeing my precautions in the cool blue light of early morning, I was a little embarrassed. I couldn't remember whether I'd slept on the floor out of fear of assassins or bedbugs. Either way, it was clear that I hadn't been thinking too clearly towards the end of the night. I gathered up my travel sack and loot and headed downstairs. I had some planning to do. But before that, I needed breakfast and a bath. Despite my busy night, I'd barely slept past sunrise, so I had easy access to the bathhouse. After cleaning myself up and rewrapping the bandage around my side, I felt mostly human. A plate of eggs, a couple of sausages, and some fried potatoes later, I felt I could begin to think rationally about my situation. It's amazing how much easier it is to think productively when your belly is full. I sat in the far corner of the little dockside inn and sipped a mug of fresh-pressed apple cider. I was no longer worried that hired killers were going to leap out and assault me. Still, I was sitting with my back to the wall, with a good view of the door. Yesterday had left me shaken, mostly because it had caught me so unprepared. In Tarbin, I'd lived each day expecting people would try to kill me. The civilized atmosphere of the university had lulled me into a false sense of security. I never would have been caught off my guard a year ago. I certainly wouldn't have been surprised by the attack itself. My hard-won instincts from Tarbin were urging me to run, leave this place, leave Ambrose and his vendetta far behind. But that feral part of me cared only for safety. It had no plan. I couldn't leave. I had too much invested here. My studies, my vain hopes for gaining a patron, and my stronger hopes of entry to the archives, my precious few friends. Denner. Sailors and dock workers began to filter into the inn to get the morning meal, and the room slowly filled with the gentle buzz of conversation. I heard a bell ringing dimly in the distance, and it occurred to me that my shift in the medica would be starting in an hour. Arwill would notice if I was absent, and he was not forgiving of such things. I fought down the urge to run back to the university. It was well known that absent students were punished with higher tuitions the following term. To give myself something to do while I was thinking through my situation, I brought out my cloak along with needle and thread. The knife from last night had made a straight cut about 2 handspan across. I began to sew it closed, using tiny stitches so the seam wouldn't be obvious. While my hands worked, my thoughts wandered. Could I confront Ambrose? Threaten him? Not likely. He knew I couldn't successfully bring charges against him, but maybe I could persuade a few of the masters of what had really happened. Kilvin would be outraged at the thought of hired killers using a dowsing compass, and perhaps Arwill.
All blue fire! Every one of them dead, thrown around like rag dolls, and the house falling to pieces around them! I was glad to see the end of the place, I can tell you that!
I jabbed my finger with the needle as my eavesdropper's ears picked the conversation out of the common room's general din. A few tables over, 2 men were drinking beer. One was tall and balding, the other was fat with a red beard.
Ha ha! You're such an old woman!
The fat one laughed.
You'll listen to any piece of gossip!
The tall man shook his head somberly.
I was in the tavern when they came in with the news. They were gathering folk with wagons so they could go get the bodies. The old wedding party, dead as leather. Over 30 folks gutted like pigs, and the place burned down in a blue flame. And that weren't the least oddness from what...
He dropped his voice, and I lost what he was saying among the general noise of the room. I swallowed against the sudden dryness in my throat. I slowly tied off the last stitch on my cloak and set it down. I noticed my bleeding finger, and absently put it in my mouth. I took a deep breath. I took a drink. Then I walked over to the table where the 2 men sat talking.
Did you gentlemen come downriver by any chance?
They looked up, obviously irritated by the interruption. Gentlemen had been a mistake. I should have said fellows, fellas. The bald one nodded.
Did you come by way of Marrow?
I asked, picking a northern town at random.
No,
the fat one said.
We're down from Trebon.
Oh, good, I said, my mind racing for a plausible lie. I have family up in those parts. I was thinking of visiting.
My mind went blank as I tried to think of a way to ask him for the details of the story I'd overheard. My palms were sweaty.
Are they getting ready for the harvest festival up that way, or have I already missed it?
I finished lamely.
Still in the works,
the bald one said, and pointedly turned his shoulder to me.
I'd heard there was some problem with a wedding up in those parts.
The bald one turned back to look at me.
Well, I don't know how you'd have heard that, as the news was fresh last night and we just docked down here 10 minutes ago.
He gave me a hard look.
I don't know what you're selling, boy, but I ain't buying. Piss off, or I'll thump you.
I went back to my seat, knowing I'd made an irrecoverable mess of things. I sat, keeping my hands flat on the table to keep them from shaking. A group of people, brutally killed. Blue fire. Oddness. Chandrian. Less than a day ago, the Chandrian were in Trebon. I finished my drink more out of reflex than anything else, then stood and made my way to the bar. I was quickly coming to grips with the reality of the situation. After all these years, I finally had the opportunity to learn something about the Chandrian, and not just a mention of them pressed flat between the pages of a book in the archives. I had the chance to see their work firsthand. This was an opportunity that might never come again. But I needed to get to Trebon soon, while things were still fresh in people's memories, before curious or superstitious townsfolk destroyed what evidence remained. I didn't know what I hoped to find, but anything I learned about the Chandrian would be more than I knew now, and if I were to have a chance at anything useful, I had to be there as soon as possible. Today. The morning crowd was keeping the innkeeper busy, so I had to lay an iron drab on the bar before she paid me any attention at all. After paying for a private room last night and breakfast and bath this morning, The drab represented a good portion of my worldly wealth, so I kept my finger on it.
"What you have?"
she asked as she came up to me.
"How far is it to Trebon?"
I asked.
"Up river. Couple of days."
I didn't ask how long it was. I need to know how far, I said, stressing the last word.
"No need to get snippy,"
she said, wiping her hands on her grubby apron.
"By river, it's 40 miles or so. Could take more than 2 days, depending on if you're on a barge or a billow boat, and what the weather's like."
"How far by road?" I asked.
"Black and me if I know,"
she muttered, then called down the bar.
"Rod, how far to Trebon by road?"
3 or 4 days,
said a weathered man without looking up from his mug.
"I asked how far,"
she snapped at him.
"Is it longer than the riverway?"
"Damn sight longer, about 25 legs by road. A hard road too, uphill."
God's body, who measured things in leagues these days? Depending on where that fellow grew up, a league could be anywhere between 2 to 3.5 miles. My father always claimed that a league wasn't really a unit of measurement at all, just a way for farmers to attach numbers to their rough guesses. Still, it let me know Trebon was somewhere between 50 and 80 miles to the north. It was probably best to assume the worst, at least 70 miles. The woman behind the bar turned back to me.
"There you have it. Now, can I get you something?"
"I need a water skin if you have one, or a bottle of water if you don't, and some food that will keep on the road. Hard sausage, cheese, flatbread."
"Apples?"
she asked.
"Got some lovely red jennies this morning, good for the road."
I nodded. "And whatever else you have that's cheap and will travel."
"A drab don't go far,"
she said with a glance down at the bar. I shook out my purse and was surprised to see 4 drabs and a copper halfpenny I hadn't accounted for. I was practically rich. She gathered up my money and headed back to the kitchen. I fought off the momentary pang at being utterly destitute again and ran a quick mental inventory of what I had in my travel sack. She came back with 2 loaves of flatbread, a thick, hard sausage that smelled of garlic, a small cheese sealed in wax, a bottle of water, 6 gorgeous bright red apples, and a small sack of carrots and potatoes. I thanked her kindly and stuffed the lot into my sack. 70 miles. I could make it today, if I had a good horse, but good horses cost money. I breathed in the smell of rancid fat as I knocked on Devi's door. I stood there for a minute, fighting the urge to fidget impatiently. I had no idea if Devi would be awake at such an early hour, but it was a risk I had to take. Devi opened the door and smiled when she saw me.
"Well, here's a pleasant surprise."
She opened the door wider.
"Come in, sit down."
I gave her my best smile. "Devi, I just..." She frowned. "Come in," she said more firmly. "I don't discuss business on the landing." I came in, and she closed the door behind me.
"Take a seat, unless you'd rather have a bit of a lie down."
She nodded playfully toward the huge curtained bed in the corner of the room.
"You won't believe the story I heard this morning,"
she said, laughter hiding in her voice. Despite the urgency I felt, I forced myself to relax. Devi was not one to be rushed. If I tried, it would only irritate her.
"What did you hear?"
She sat on her side of the desk and folded her hands.
"Apparently, last night a pair of ruffians tried to lift a purse off a young student. Much to their dismay, it turns out he's the next Tarballin in training. He called down fire and lightning, blinded one and gave the other such a mighty blow to the head that he still hasn't woken up."
I sat quietly for a moment as I absorbed the information. An hour ago this would have been the best news I could have heard. Now it was hardly more than a distraction. Still, despite the urgency of my other errand, I couldn't ignore the chance to gather some information about the crisis closer to home.
"They weren't just trying to rob me," I said.
Devi laughed.
"Oh, I knew it was you! They didn't know anything about him except for that he had red hair. But that was enough for me."
"Did I really blind the one?" I asked. "And the other still unconscious?" "I honestly don't know," Devi admitted. News travels quickly among us unsavory types, but it's mostly gossip.
My mind was spinning quickly along a new plan now.
Would you care to spread a little gossip of your own?
I asked.
That depends.
She gave a wicked smile.
Is it terribly exciting?
Drop my name, I said. Let them know exactly who it was. Let them know I'm mad as hell and I'll kill the next ones that come after me. I'll kill them and whoever hired them, the middlemen, their families, their dogs, the whole lot.
Devi's delighted expression faded to something closer to distaste.
That's a little grim, don't you think?
I appreciate that you're attached to your purse, she gave me a playful look, and I have a vested interest there myself.
But there's no...
They weren't thieves, I said. They were hired to kill me.
Devi gave me a skeptical look. I tugged up the corner of my shirt to show my bandage.
I'm serious. I can show you where one of them cut me before I got away.
Frowning, she stood up and came around to the other side of the desk.
All right, show me.
I hesitated, then decided that I was better off humoring her, as I still had favors to ask. I took off my shirt and lay it on the desk.
That bandage is filthy,
she said, as if it was a personal offense.
Get rid of it.
She walked to a cabinet at the back of the room and came back with a black physica's kit and a wash basin. She washed her hands, then looked at my side.
You haven't even had it stitched,
she said incredulously. I've been rather busy, I said, with the running like hell and hiding all night. She ignored me and set about cleaning my side with a cool efficiency that let me know she'd studied in the medica.
It's messy, but not deep, she said. It's not even all the way through the skin in some places.
She stood up and pulled a few things out of her bag.
You'll still need stitches.
I would have done it myself, I said, but...
But you're an idiot who didn't even make sure this was cleaned properly, she finished. If this gets infected, it would serve you right.
She finished cleaning my side and rinsed her hands in the bowl.
I want you to know I'm doing this because I have a soft spot for pretty boys, the mentally infirm, and people who owe me money. I consider this protecting my investment.
Yes, ma'am. I sucked in air when she applied the antiseptic.
I thought you weren't supposed to bleed, she said matter-of-factly. There's another legend proven false.
Speaking of, moving as little as possible, I reached out and pulled a book out of my travel sack, then laid it on her desk.
I brought back your copy of Mating Habits of the Common Dracus. You were right, the engravings added a lot to it. I knew you'd like it.
There was a moment of silence as she began stitching me back together. When she spoke again, most of the playfulness was gone from her voice.
Were these fellows really hired to kill you, Quoth?
I nodded.
They had a dousing compass and some of my hair. That's how they knew I was a redhead.
Lord and lady, wouldn't that just send Kilvin into a froth?
She shook her head.
Are you sure they weren't just hired to scare you, rough you up a little, to teach you to mind your betters?
She paused in her stitching and looked up at me.
You weren't stupid enough to borrow money off Heffron and his boys, were you?
I shook my head.
You're the only hawk for me, Devi, I smiled. In fact, that's why I stopped by today.
And here I thought you merely enjoyed my company,
she said, turning back to her needlework. I thought I detected a tinge of irritation in her voice.
Let me finish this first.
I thought about what she'd said for a long moment. The tall man had said, let's do him, but that could mean any number of things.
It's possible
they weren't trying to kill me, I admitted slowly.
He had a knife, though. You don't need a knife to give someone a beating.
Devi snorted.
Huh, and I don't need blood to get people to settle their debts, but it certainly helps.
I thought about it as she tied off the final stitch and began to wrap me in a fresh bandage. Maybe it was meant to be a simple beating, an anonymous message from Ambrose telling me to mind my betters. Maybe it was a simple attempt to scare me off. I sighed, trying not to move too much as I did so.
I'd like to believe that's the case, but I really don't think so. I think they were really after blood. That's what my gut tells me.
Her expression grew serious.
In that case, I will spread the word a little, she said.
I don't know about the part about killing their dogs, but I'll drop a few things into the rumour mill so people will think twice about taking that sort of job. She chuckled low in her throat. Actually, they're already thinking twice after last night. This will make them think three times. I appreciate it. Small trouble to make, she said dismissively as she stood up and brushed off her knees. A small favour to help a friend. She washed her hands in the basin, then dried them carelessly on her shirt. Let's hear it, she said as she sat behind the desk, her expression suddenly businesslike. I need money for a fast horse, I said.
Leaving town?
She arched a pale eyebrow.
You never struck me as the running away sort.
I'm not running, I said, but I need to cover some ground, 70 miles before it gets much afternoon. Devi widened her eyes a bit.
A horse that could make that trip is going to cost, she said.
Why not just buy a post note and switch out fresh horses all the way, faster and cheaper?
There's no post stations where I'm going, I said. Up river, then into the hills, little town called Trebon.
All right, she said. How much are you looking for?
I'll need money to buy a fast horse with no dickering, plus lodging, food, maybe bribes. 20 talents? She burst out laughing, then regained her composure and covered her mouth.
No, I'm sorry, but no. I do have a soft spot for charming young men like yourself, but it's not on my head.
I have my lute, I said, sliding the case forward with my foot.
For collateral, plus anything else in here.
I put my travel sack on the desk. She drew a breath as if to refuse me out of hand, then shrugged and looked into the bag, poking around. She pulled out my copy of Rhetoric and Logic, and a moment later my handheld sympathy lamp.
Hello,
she said curiously, thumbing on the switch and pointing the light towards the wall.
This is interesting.
I grimaced.
Anything except that, I said. I promised Kilvin I wouldn't ever let that out of my hands.
I gave my word.
She gave me a frank look.
Have you ever heard the expression, beggars can't be choosers?
I gave my word, I repeated.
I unpinned my silver talent pipes from my cloak and slid them across her desk so they lay near Rhetoric and Logic.
Those aren't easy to come by, you know.
Devi looked at the lute, the book, and the pipes, and drew a long, slow breath.
Quoth, I can tell that this is important to you, but the numbers just don't add. You're not good for that much money. You're barely good for the 4 talents you owe me.
That stung, mostly because I knew it to be the truth. Devi thought about it for another second, then shook her head firmly.
No, just the interest. In 2 months you'd owe me over 35 talents.
Or something equally valuable in trade, I said. She gave me a gentle smile.
And what do you have worth 35 talents?
Access to the archives. Devi sat, her slightly patronizing smile frozen on her face.
You're lying.
I shook my head. I know there's another way in. I haven't found it yet, but I will.
That's a lot of if.
Devi's tone was skeptical, but her eyes were full of something more than simple desire. It was closer to hunger or lust. I could tell she wanted into the archives just as badly as I did, perhaps even more so. That's what I'm offering, I said. If I can pay you back, I will. If not, when I find a way into the archives, I'll share it with you. Devi looked up at the ceiling, as if calculating odds in her head.
With these things as collateral, and the possibility of access to the archives, I can loan you 12 talents.
I stood up and swung my travel sack over my shoulder.
I'm afraid we're not bargaining here, I said. I'm just informing you as to the conditions of the loan.
I gave her an apologetic smile.
It's 20 talents, or nothing.
I'm sorry I didn't make that clear from the beginning.
Chapter 71 Strange Attraction 3 minutes later I strode towards the doors of the nearest livery. A well-dressed Kildish man smiled at